Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. With the election of Donald Trump and the further fracturing of American political life that began far before the rise of Trump to power, many historians, journalists, and even everyday people, including myself, have tried to find historical parallels that help provide context for today. One period that I hear people continually going back to is the era of the Civil War, but not just the war itself. When I say the era of the Civil War, I'm talking about the decade before the Civil War, the 1850s, and the decades that followed, known as Reconstruction. The era of the Civil War was a period of intense fragmentation that corresponded with geography, the North versus the South. Our fragmentation today, though not the same, and it's not the exact same story either, still can also be seen as a geographical phenomenon. Today, we focus on the 1850s, the decade before the Civil War. Tomorrow, we look at the dramatic dynamic between Abraham Lincoln and the radical Republicans who were pushing for full racial equality. And on Thursday, the Reconstruction era and the three monumental constitutional amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which have been characterized as the founding of a second republic that would also create a world and the political battles that we're still struggling with today. So without further delay, the 1850s and Eric Foner. Eric Foner, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
Thanks, Mitch, for having me.
It's good to have you. You have spent an entire career on the Civil War era and Reconstruction. What is it about what I guess is basically the second half of the 19th century that calls to you?
Well, of course, it's the profound issue of slavery, of civil war, of the country's attempt to deal with the destruction of slavery, to debate and fight over the status of African Americans in our history. I mean, I became interested in this era for two reasons. When I was an undergraduate, one, which is very important, is I had a wonderful teacher, an inspiring teacher here at Columbia, James Shenton, who, a teacher can really somehow inspire your interest and fascination with a particular moment or question. But maybe more than that, this is the 1960s. The country was going through the Civil Rights Revolution, a great crisis over our racial systems. And people like me who were interested in history, young people, undergrad and graduates, who wanted to know where this came from. Where in our history did the crisis we were seeing in the streets originate? And of course, the kind of mainstream history at that time didn't give us an answer. It was what they called the consensus era, where scholars were arguing that really there was no particular history of ideological conflict or deep division over fundamental values in American history. That made it hard to explain the Civil War, but putting it aside, suddenly we saw the society fracturing, and we wanted to know the history that had been the prelude or had produced this. So many of us, I'm not the only one, began studying slavery, anti-slavery, Reconstruction. The Civil Rights era was sometimes called the Second Reconstruction, so that leads, inexorably back to the first one to figure out what went right, what went wrong, and how come a century after the first Reconstruction we needed to have a second Reconstruction.
We're going to get to this, the Reconstruction, towards the end of our conversation, or the later part of our conversation, but yeah, one can make the argument the Civil Rights Act of the 1960s, the Voting Rights Act of the 1960s were very much connected to Reconstruction and the amendments, 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments, especially the 14th and 15th Amendment that came after the Civil War. Took 100 years.
Right. That is absolutely true. It took 100 years for the country to get back to the agenda of Reconstruction and to get back to the commitments that were put into our Constitution as what Martin Luther King, when he gave his great speech at the Lincoln Memorial, called a promissory note. He was talking about the Emancipation Proclamation, but he said 100 years later, this promissory note to black Americans has never yet been cashed out. The country promised a lot of things which it didn't deliver on, and we were facing the consequences of that 100 years later. But I think one of the key points in terms of your overall question is that historians tend to write with at least one eye on the present. The present gives us our questions. It doesn't give us the answers. You know, saying, I want to study the history of race and racial relations and systems and conflicts doesn't tell us what the answers are going to be. But it's the world we're living in that opens up questions that we try to answer historically. So it shouldn't be surprising that in the midst of the civil rights era, a lot of young historians like myself were, you know, looking into these questions. And I've sort of been, as you said, I've been in that period ever since with a little diversions. I wrote a book about Thomas Paine and the American Revolution sometime after I finished my doctoral dissertation. So I haven't been totally stuck in the Civil War era, but pretty much that's where most of my scholarship has resided.
My understanding is, I guess, as you were working towards your PhD, you also worked with the great historian of the 20th century, Richard Hofstadter.
Oh, absolutely. He was my mentor, my PhD supervisor. It was a wonderful thing to have him as, you know, your critic, your in-house critic. Well, Hofstadter was not actually a great teacher. I mentioned James Shenton, who inspired me to get into this era, was a great teacher. Hofstadter was a writer. He once said to me, I'm a writer. I teach because I need to get a salary. But as a critic, he was magnificent. A lot of what I learned about writing came directly from Hofstadter, from just going over his, you know, pencil marks on a draft of a chapter or something like that. You know, the craft of writing, which unfortunately we don't teach enough in graduate school to historians. You know, the craft, how do you integrate quotations into your narrative? How do you vary sentence structure? How do you use, as he always told us, active verbs? Make war on the passive voice, he kept saying, you know. Another thing Hofstadter drilled into us was that 90% of writing is rewriting. You when you finish your first draft, you begin. You don't end at that point. The actual craft of writing begins in the revision process. And that's actually a very liberating idea, you know, that you don't have to worry whether your first draft is perfect or even very good. It sort of just gets your ideas down in order, and then the process of writing begins. So, you know, it was great working with Hofstadter. And one thing I'll say about Hofstadter, you know, he had no interest in developing a school of followers. He didn't force his ideas onto you. Like any really, you know, good mentor, he wanted to help you do the best you could with what you wanted to do. So as I mentioned, he was a practitioner of what they used to call the consensus school of, you know, that there wasn't a lot of conflict in American history. But in the 60s, a lot of his students, like me, were looking at ideological conflict in American history. He didn't take this as an affront. He didn't take this as a challenge to his outlook. He helped us do the best that we could with what we wanted to do.
We have done shows on Richard Hofstadter, and in particular his work, The Paranoid Style in American Politics, which was really looked, you know, sort of focused on the rise of the conservative movement in the 1960s, post Barry Goldwater, and I guess the reaction to the civil rights movement. Did you see any connection to that kind of work, to what you have dived into in the Civil War era?
Well, not really. In fact, my attitude, my outlook is rather different from that. I mean, Hofstadter, yes, he was pretty freaked out by the rise of the, what they called then the New Right, the Goldwater people and the people around Goldwater and Goldwater's campaign in 1964, which of course was very unsuccessful as a presidential campaign, but did lay the foundation for a much bigger growth of conservatism in the 1970s. You know, he wasn't only interested in that. His book, the Paranoid Style, Anti-Intellectualism in American Life, you know, he felt these were endemic qualities of American life, which he deplored. He went back to the populists, to others, and argued they were all conspiratorial-minded. They really didn't have a keen, you know, a clear analysis of the economic problems facing them. They were prone to these paranoid fantasies about international bankers or Jews or others manipulating the economy. Meanwhile, I was studying ideology, how anti-slavery people actually tried to come to terms with the real power of slavery in American life. It was not paranoia when anti-slavery people said, you know, there's a slave power that is dominating the federal government. That was fact. And they were trying to figure out what to do about it. So, you know, whereas Hofstadter saw political enthusiasm as inherently dangerous because, you know, because Americans are just prone to these outbursts of irrationality, I saw this as something that was a prelude to the 1960s, a kind of how did a mass politics bent on eliminating the greatest evil in American society, how did they develop and grow and eventually succeed? So, in a sense, my sensibility was very different from Hofstadter's. But as I said, that wasn't the point at all, as far as either he or I was concerned.
Well, let's get into the story that we're going to talk about. And let's begin in the 1850s. And I have to tell you, I am wildly interested in the political history of the Civil War. And it's a recent interest that I have acquired, because before, whenever I heard about the Civil War, it was always a military history, and obviously a history of slavery too, but a lot of battles that I just wasn't that interested in. And then in 2016, or it's 2017, with the beginning of the Trump presidency, I was a former congressional correspondent, and I went back to Washington, D.C. to cover the beginning of the administration. And I met with the official Senate historian, Betty Coed. And I asked her, I was like, can you remember, can you think of any time in the past that is as wild of a political moment as we are right now experiencing? And she just laughed at me. And she said, of course, the 1850s, the decade before the Civil War.
Yeah, we have a tendency to have a little bit of historical amnesia in this country, and people think that whatever we are living through is completely unprecedented. The 1790s was a period of intense political, you know, political division and hyper-partisanship. We haven't yet gotten to the point where two major political figures engage in a duel, and one of them kills the other. Aaron Burr, the Jeffersonian candidate for vice president in 1800, and Alexander Hamilton, the Secretary of the Treasury under Washington. In other words, passions were pretty intense at that time, as well as now. And in the 1850s, obviously, it produced a civil war. We have a lot of problems now, but I don't think we're on the verge of an outright civil war. So she's completely right, that they're... Now, of course, today, these partisan attacks fly around instantaneously, thanks to the internet, the media, social media, etc. Back then, it took a little longer for these insults and accusations to circulate widely, but whether that makes any difference, I'm not sure.
The 1850s is, again, a really intense, interesting period of time, mm-hmm. which if you really think about it, makes sense. It's the decade before the Civil War. And one of the things about the 1850s that is obviously in many ways different from now, but in one way that it reminds me of now is just the changes that were happening in the 1850s, not just political changes, but also technological changes, changes to the economy, how the economies operated. That part was really interesting.
Yeah. Well, those changes were pulling the country apart in certain respects. In the North, the most fundamental change was really the completion of a big, big railroad network, which opened up vast areas of the Midwest to commercial farming. You know, previously, if you didn't have a farm pretty near a body of water, a canal, a major river like the Ohio or the Mississippi, you couldn't get your goods to market. Suddenly, the railroad doesn't have to worry about climate or about whether rivers freeze in the winter or that kind of thing. And so you had a big expansion of commercial agriculture. But that links the Midwest with the East. Manufactured goods, you also have the rise of a factory system in the eastern states. Manufactured goods from the East are flowing westward on the railroads. Farm products, wheat, corn, etc., hogs are flowing eastward on the railroads. And that is creating a real, integration between the Northeast and the Midwest, which leaves the South out. And in a sense, the Republican Party, as which emerges in the 1850s as a sectional party of the North and the what they called the Old Northwest, which today is, you know, Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, et cetera, Michigan. The Republicans are a party of those regions with no presence in the South whatsoever, and their unifying principle is stopping the westward expansion of slavery. So you have a kind of economic process which is underpinning a political realignment, which both of them are dividing the country along this North-South axis.
The expansion of slavery is so important. And of course, in understanding the issue over expansion of slavery, it's necessary to go back to the 1840s and the Mexican-American War. Why was that war so important, and why would that inevitably lead us to the Civil War?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the issue of the expansion of slavery goes back way before that. The Northwest Ordinance in 1787 had banned slavery in the Northwestern territories, Ohio, etc. 1820, the Missouri controversy and the Missouri Compromise is all about the westward expansion of slavery. Slavery now jumps the Mississippi River, as Missouri is admitted as a slave state. But certainly, in other words, whenever new territory is acquired, like the Louisiana Purchase, which the Missouri Compromise tried to deal with the status of slavery there, or in the Mexican War, where this vast new area in the Southwest is added to the United States from Mexico, the question always arises, are these going to be free states, slave states? There's a sort of national balance of between the sections of political power, and adding new territory has, you know, poses the possibility of disrupting that in the interests of one or the other section. So whenever you have new territory, you have this question of the status of slavery there. And of course, the Compromise of 1850, which begins the 1850s decade, is an attempt, doesn't work very well, to settle this question, to create an arrangement which is satisfactory to both North and South. It kind of lasts for 4 years, and that's not long enough. But every time you got new territory, yes. One of the reasons for that is that it was widely accepted, except for a few abolitionists, that the federal government had no power over slavery. Congress couldn't just pass a law abolishing slavery in South Carolina if it wanted to. This was a state matter. Slavery was created by state law. A state could abolish slavery. Several northern states did, Pennsylvania, New York, etc., in the early 19th century. The federal government had no influence over slavery in the states. But when it comes to territory, new territories, the federal government does have power there. So that makes it a national issue, whether slavery is going to go into, as you said, New Mexico, Arizona, California, the areas stolen, actually, you'd have to say, from Mexico. That's a national issue, and national politics comes to center on it.
I don't think most people know very much about the Mexican-American War, never mind that it seemed like half the country, half of the United States, opposed that war.
Yeah, there was a lot of opposition to the war. Many Northerners felt that this war was motivated by a desire to spread slavery into this southwestern territory, to acquire new land for slavery. They'd already done that very recently, really just a year or two before the Mexican War, by the annexation of Texas, which had been part of Mexico and, you know, gained its independence in 1836 and then 8 years, 9 years later is annexed to the United States. That is a slave state. And now there are people in the North who say, well, look, they're now looking to expand even further by acquiring, New Mexico, Utah, California, et cetera. Abraham Lincoln was one of the strong opponents of the Mexican War. Henry David Thoreau went to jail in Massachusetts rather than pay taxes because he said, my tax money is being used to support an unjust war. So there was quite a good bit of opposition to the war, no question.
Ulysses S. Grant was opposed to the war too, wasn't he? a general.
Yeah, he later said in his memoirs, Grant, that this was the most unjust war ever waged by one strong, you know, by a strong power against a weak one, you know. Nonetheless, nothing succeeds like success, you know. So the United States did succeed in winning the war. It did succeed in acquiring all this new territory from Mexico. And so a lot of people said, oh, all right, it worked out okay. But as Emerson, I think, said, it was like absorbing all that territory was a dose of arsenic for the system of the United States, because it threw again this question of the expansion of slavery right into the center of the political system.
Why did the North care about the spread of slavery through the new territories?
That's a great question. That's the question I try to answer in my first book, which was my doctoral dissertation, Free Soil, Free Labor, Free Men, which was about the rise of the Republican Party, the ideology that held it together. And why should a Northerner worry about whether there's slavery in Kansas or not, or, you know, or New Mexico or California? Well, the fact is that these were areas that many people, you know, westward, the westward movement of population was something that was, you know, very prevalent in the first part of the 19th century. So many people in the North and the West expected to move further west. If they didn't, their children, their sons and daughters would move further west. This is where opportunity lay in acquiring new land, you know, moving up the social scale. And if slavery took over those areas, nobody wanted to go and compete with slave labor. Nobody, and many of them were racist. They didn't want to go to a place full of black people either. The feeling was, this actually affects me or my children, because it's either slavery going in there or free labor going in there. And I don't want to be connected with a slave society. I don't want to be connected with competing with slave labor. I don't want to be in a place where big plantation owners kind of monopolize all the good land and the political power, as they did in much of the South. So even though we may not see that, many, many Northerners felt this was something that was directly relevant to them.
That's an important point. Can you talk to me about the differences at this period of time between the economies of the South, which are slave states, and the North, which mostly are not slave states? So I guess a few that would join the North for the Civil War would still be slave states, but majority. What's the economic differences here that are important?
Well, it's sort of complicated, because slavery was by far the most powerful economic institution in the country, and the profit, you know, the United States sat on a virtual monopoly of cotton, the most important crop in world trade at that point, the raw material of the early Industrial Revolution. And so the profits of slavery were immense, and a lot of that money flowed into the North. It was Northern ships that were carrying cotton to England for their cotton factories. It was Northern bankers who were extending loans to slave owners to enable them to purchase more land. It was Northern insurance companies that were writing insurance policies on slaves. So if a slave died, the owner got compensated, not the family. It's not like an insurance policy today where if you die, your wife gets it. No, it's the owner gets an insurance payment. And of course, there were cotton factories all over New England which were using slave-grown cotton. So there was a kind of symbiotic relationship between the Northern economy and the Southern in that sense. But the fundamental bases, the labor systems, were entirely different. You know, in my book on the Republican Party, I argued it's this concept of free labor which holds the party together. You read Lincoln's speeches, he talks about this all the time. The North is a place where the average working man, through his own hard labor, can rise in the social scale, can enjoy the fruits of his own labor, he and his family. And he says black people are entitled to that also. Lincoln was not a racial egalitarian, but he said this is a natural right of everybody. It's mentioned in the Declaration of Independence obliquely, the right to the pursuit of happiness, the right to improve your condition of in life. Slaves don't have that, and many, many poorer whites also don't have it in a slave state. So this contrast between a society based on free labor and a society based on slave labor really becomes, in a way, the crux of the whole political debate in the 1850s.
And this is interesting to me, the paid labor, free labor versus slave labor. And in some ways, but obviously not every way, reminds me somewhat of arguments and issues surrounding immigration today. And that is, you would have people in the North, they weren't racial justice folks. They weren't for racial equality. It wasn't even a moral issue for them, though for some it was, and we'll talk about that. But it was this idea of slave labor undercutting free labor, poor laborers in the North.
Yeah, well, the working man, that labor was, as they claim, labor was not respected in the South. It's true. In a slave society, labor is considered degrading. Labor is something associated with slavery. Moreover, putting labor aside, there was this question of what Republicans called the slave power, that a slave society is undemocratic fundamentally, that the people who rise to the top, who control the political system, are the big slave owners. And, they're the ones who are the wealthiest, they're the ones who dominate the political system, and they also have a very powerful impact on the national government by the 1850s. You know, between the time the Constitution was ratified and 1850, just about every president was a slave owner. I mean, yes, John Quincy Adams wasn't, William Henry Harrison, but he died after one term in office, Martin Van Buren, you can name, but almost all of them were Southern slave owners. The Supreme Court was dominated by Southern slave owners. The South had enough power in Congress to block anti-slavery measures. So, there was also just this question of the power of slavery in the political system, which disadvantaged Northerners, regardless of their political outlook. So all of these things kind of come together in what I call this free labor ideology, which says basically there are these two systems at odds in the United States, the slave system and the free labor system, and one of them is going to dominate the future. And the focal point for that conflict becomes the Western territories. Who is going to control the Western territories? And that will really set the course of development for the whole country for the next, several decades at least.
And I think that gets us to one of the most consequential pieces of legislation that became law in U.S. history. And that's the 1854 Kansas-Nebraska Act. What was important? What's important to know about that act?
Well, as I mentioned, in 1850, you had this carefully worked out compromise, which I don't want to go into all the details, but seemed to settle the problem of the Western territories. That applied to the area acquired from Mexico, the Mexican cession. Now, that, even though people were debating it, that was pretty far away from the East, and there weren't a heck of a lot of people moving out there right away. But the Kansas-Nebraska Act overturned the Missouri Compromise. That dealt with the area of the Louisiana Purchase, which was right in the center of the United States. You had these territories, Kansas and Nebraska, right there. Now, under the Missouri Compromise of 1820, slavery was prohibited in those territories. But Southerners began demanding, well, hey, if those states are going to develop economically, politically, we got to have a shake there. We got to have a right to bring our slaves in there. And, as a result for many other reasons, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, in effect, opens up this territory of the Louisiana Purchase to the possible expansion of slavery. It says basically Congress is not going to keep slavery either in or out. It's up to the settlers. The white settlers who go in there, they can vote whether they want slavery or not. Now, that seems democratic. Hey, all right, let the local people decide what they want, and then the rest of the country doesn't have to fight over it. But if you think about it, it becomes almost unworkable right off. When is this vote going to take place? Is it the first 20 guys who go in, they're going to vote? Or do you need a certain population, 10,000, 20,000? And what's going to be the status of slavery before that? Can slave owners bring their slaves in before this referendum or whatever kind of decision-making process takes place? Moreover, you are repealing a prohibition on slavery, so that obviously seems to be hostile to Northern interests. So the Kansas-Nebraska Act really blew up the political system. The Whig Party, which had existed for 20-odd years, kind of falls apart between Northern and Southern factions. The Northern Whigs tend to be anti-slavery, the Southern Whigs pro-slavery. The Democratic Party suffers many defections. This is a Democratic Party measure. The Democratic Party holds together, but a good number of them go off and join the new Republican Party, which is created to stop the westward expansion of slavery. So the political system goes through really the last total realignment in our history. We are still today stuck with, you might say, the two major parties that emerged out of the debacle of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. It's the last time that one of the two major parties disappeared and a new one rose to take its place.
And the formation of the Republican Party was principally to take on what they considered to be the slave power?
It was to take on the slave power. It was to sort of make sure that free labor dominated the Western territories, not slave labor, et cetera. So, it was to confront Southern power and the Southern system of society. But it was also positive. If you read, this is one of the big arguments of my early book, that it was a glorification of Northern society. It wasn't just negative. You say anti-slavery. No, it was positive. Free society is superior to slave society. Free society is economically more efficient, more valuable. Free society enables ordinary men, men basically, to rise in the social scale through their own hard work. So if you're choosing which of these societies is going to dominate the future, the heartland of America and the West, that's the issue. It's an issue of the future. Is this country going to be fundamentally a slave-owning country or a free labor country? And that is the issue that brings on the Civil War.
And that's also very much about free market capitalism.
Well, of course, yes, they are capitalists, but it's a small-scale capitalism. This is not the capitalism of U.S. Steel, later on, or Amazon, or other predatory giant organizations. This is the capitalism of the small shop, of the artisan, of the small commercial farmer. Yes, there are factories in New England, but, most production in the North is in very small-scale operations. You don't have these giant factories until much later. But it's certainly capitalist. I mean, what's the alternative at that time? It's not as if there's a lot of socialists running around. It's a free market kind of idea of people competing in what Lincoln calls the race of life, trying to get ahead, the race of life. But remember, the race must be fair. In a slave society, the race is not fair. The slave has no chance to compete in the race of life. Most poor white people don't have much chance to compete in the race of life. A lot of people in the South have a big head start. The idea, which is not 100% accurate as a description, Lincoln says this over and over, the poor, penniless beginner, through his own hard work, thanks to free labor society, can rise in the social scale. Not to being rich, but to being independent, to have a livelihood, a middle-class existence. It's that kind of capitalism. It's the capitalism before giant factories. It's the capitalism before a permanent working class that doesn't actually have the ability to rise out of that status. That's a late 19th century phenomenon, but it shouldn't be read back into the 1850s.
What was the South capitalist? Could we define it as capitalist during this period?
How many hours do you have?
Well, we still have another two.
That's a big debate. That's a big debate among historians.
Yeah.
That's a big debate.
Interesting.
One of the most important scholars of the previous generation and someone who had an enormous influence on me when I was starting out was Eugene Genovese, who wrote extensively on slavery. And he argued the South was not really capitalist, or to put it in a more obscure way, it was in but not of the capitalist system. I mean, after all, how did planters make a living? They sold a basic crop on the world market. So that's capitalist. They're marketing their crop and making a lot of money off of it. However, the internal relations of owner and worker in slavery are quite different than those in a free labor system. Now, Genovese went on to argue that that produces a non-capitalist ethos, where slave owners kind of feel that the slaves are part of a paternalistic system, where they have a responsibility for their black slaves, which northern employers don't have any such responsibility. You can fire a worker in a factory. You can't really fire a slave, although you could sell a slave, which is something that Genovese didn't really deal with very much in his books. Today, however, I think most historians, younger historians, say, no, slavery was an integral part of the capitalist system of that era. The profits of slavery flowed into the Industrial Revolution, flowed into economic advancements, railroads. Slave owners were quite attuned to the ups and downs of the world market. They pioneered various kinds of, bookkeeping and other capital modes of keeping track of your capitalist, wherewithal. So I think today most historians see slavery as a form of capitalism, but it's not the same thing as the free labor capitalism of the North.
So now, after the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and as you indicated, it brings questions. How are you going to implement it? And what this act says is each state legislature will decide for themselves whether to be a slave labor state or a free labor state. And these questions
let me just interrupt you for one second.
Please.
Each territory will decide, not the state. Before they become a state, as a territory, they will decide whether they want slavery or not. That's what makes it tricky, because any state has the right to either have or not have slavery as they see fit.
That's right.
Pennsylvania had slavery, then they abolished it. That was fine. Everyone understood that. But a territory, as I say, that's what was new about the Kansas-Nebraska Act, in part, that it put this position, this decision, into the very early stages of territorial development. But that would then set the path. If the first, 1,000 guys voted to have slavery, you'd never be able to get rid of it. And if they voted to keep slavery out, then it would become a free territory. So that means that the conflict is shifted over to Kansas, and you have what they call bleeding Kansas. You have a kind of civil war in Kansas between people who want it to be a free territory and free state, or a slave territory and slave state. So far from settling the problem, it leads to more violence, more bloodshed, and that reverberates back into national politics.
And Bleeding Kansas is a fascinating story that I think most people don't know about. Not too long ago, I didn't know about it. And then once I learned about it, I started asking people, hey, have you ever heard of Bleeding Kansas? No, I never heard of it. What happened? And what you end up having is you have what I guess we call pro-slavery Southern Missouri ruffians flowing into Kansas. At the same time, from the North, abolitionists also flowing into Kansas in order to try to create an outcome towards their liking on the issue of slavery that erupts into literally a guerrilla war.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, the basic problem for the South was the North had more population. It was a lot easier for a small farmer in the North to pick up and move to Kansas, whatever his views on slavery, than a plantation owner. If you own a bunch of slaves, you're not going to go out to Kansas where it's unclear whether your slaves will actually be legal property or not. Whereas a farmer from up in New York State can pick up and go to Kansas. And most of the people who moved to Kansas were neither abolitionists nor pro-slavery. They were just people trying to make a living and better their condition in life, just as people have moved into other Western territories. But there were a lot more of those kind of people mobile who were not slave owners. And even if they were not anti-slavery, most of them didn't want slavery around, basically. So the South was always at a disadvantage. The only way they were going to be able to control Kansas was, A, through these Missouri ruffians, as you said, who poured across the border every time there was a territorial election and stuffed the ballot boxes so that pro-slavery people would be elected. They would have to use the political system to impose slavery on a territory where most people, it was pretty clear, didn't want it.
My understanding is when they voted that more people voted for, I guess, pro-legislature or pro-slavery than actually people who were registered to vote. That's how.
Well, there were a lot of people who poured over from Missouri. Yes, as I think Alan Nevins or David Potter said, Kansas had a very peculiar form of electoral statistics. They had a small population, but a lot of people voting for some reason. It was a little unclear where all those votes came from. But after you looked at it, they were Missourians who just came in and voted many times. Now, there were also abolitionists who went there. Of course, the most famous was John Brown, who was out there and, in fact, participated in a massacre, really, of a few pro-Southern settlers. There was violence on all sides. Pro-slavery guys burned the town of Lawrence, which was an anti-slavery, headquarters. So if the aim of the Kansas-Nebraska Act was to tamp down the, conflict over slavery, no, it didn't have that effect. It led to more violence between Northern and Southern forces, so to speak.
Yeah, we mostly think of John Brown for the raid on Harper's Ferry, which in 1859...
That came a year later or so. No, yeah. Actually 3 years after he was in Kansas, yeah.
That's right, in 1859, in which it was unsuccessful. He was captured. He would end up being executed. But what most, I think what many people may not know is we really see the rise of John Brown in Kansas as a guerrilla warrior, abolitionist. He, as you said, participated in massacres and even lost sons. It was a family affair. His son was killed in Kansas.
First of all, John Brown had about 20 children, so he had a whole little army of his own. But he had some sons out there with him, and some of them were killed. Some of them took part. What's interesting about John Brown there is that then a warrant was out for his arrest, for murder. He then was able to tour the North, raising money, meeting with people. Nobody arrested him. John Brown, it shows you the way the sectional gap was widening, that a guy like John Brown could travel the North, meeting with prominent people, renting this farm in southern Pennsylvania and Maryland, where he was plotting to invade Harper's Ferry, Virginia, now West Virginia. So it just shows you that the political situation was becoming more and more fraught.
And it's interesting during this period, and I think both Frederick Douglass as well as later E.B. Du Bois, who would write a biography on John Brown, both called John Brown a great man.
John Brown became a hero because, there's an old phrase, grass grows over the graveyard, but not over the gallows. Being executed is very good for your historical reputation, And if you think back in American history, people remember people who were executed for their beliefs, so to speak. So there were many, many labor leaders, but Joe Hill is remembered because he was executed. The Rosenbergs, there were a lot of spies out there of one kind or another. The Rosenbergs were executed, and people still remember them. Maybe the best example, of course, is two obscure Italian anarchists in the 1920s. There were a lot of Italian anarchists around. How many of them can you name except Sacco and Vanzetti?
That's right.
They were executed. So, that enhanced. John Brown became a man in the Northern eyes who paid for his beliefs with his life, Now, there are many people who don't think of John Brown that way. Some people call him a terrorist, But they didn't need to execute John Brown. They could have put him in jail, and he would not have become a great martyr in the eyes of many Northerners, but being executed and his demeanor at his trial, where he was very dignified, he spoke about slavery in a very moving way, he quoted the Bible, he didn't seem like a kind of fanatical murderer, and certainly among black people, John Brown has always been a hero, always been a hero. Here was a white man who laid down his life for the cause of the slaves, and there weren't a heck of a lot of those in the 1850s.
Did the North believe that the South was trying to have and bring slavery to the entire country? And conversely, did the South believe that the North was going to end slavery for them?
Well, by the time the Civil War breaks out, the answer is yes. At least a lot of people on both sides believed exactly what you stated. For example, the Dred Scott decision, a 6-3 the Southern-dominated Supreme Court, basically said that the country, the government has no power to keep slavery out of the territories. That the Kansas-Nebraska Act, all that, that's irrelevant because slavery has a right to go into all the territories of the country. What about states? Well, states could abolish slavery, but there was a case coming up before the Supreme Court when the war broke out called Lemon, the case of Lemon, a slave owner who from Virginia who had brought a bunch of slaves into New York State in the 1850s in violation of New York State law, and New York courts freed them. But that went up to the Supreme Court, and there was a lot of fear that the court would rule, no, slavery is legal property. Slave owners have the right to bring their slaves into any state of the Union. That doesn't mean slavery would be exactly established in New York, but you could have slaves being bought and sold and on the streets as long as their Southern owners were there with them. Lincoln said, we're thinking about stopping, you know, we're talking about stopping the expansion of slavery. We're going to wake up and the Supreme Court will have declared Illinois a slave state. So there were people who believed that was coming. And then, yes, Southerners were very alarmed at the rise of the Republican Party. Of course, they had been very alarmed by the rise of the abolitionist movement, but the Republicans were much bigger. They were now the second largest political party in the country. They were not abolitionists. They didn't. They were not trying. Their position was not to abolish slavery. It was to stop the westward expansion of slavery. But many Southerners felt this slavery would not be safe under an anti-slavery federal government, an anti-slavery president, an anti-slavery Congress. Who knew what they were going to do next? And so by the time of the Civil War, there was a lot of the kind of fear that you mentioned on both sides.
Comparing the Republican Party today to its formation in the 1850s, I can't help but say, make Republicans, make Republicans great again.
Well, of course, they are completely opposite. Then it was a sectional Northern party with no presence in the South. How shall I put it? They weren't all Martin Luther King Jr., you know, but they were devoted to, in some ways, improving the status of black Americans. Today, the center of gravity of the Republican Party is in the South. And how shall I put this? There's a lot of racism in the Republican Party. Let's just put it that way without going into a lot of detail. I don't think you can flip on your TV and not see that. So they've switched. And of course, the other way around, the Democrats were the party of slavery, racism, explicit racism. Go back to our point about political polarization. You read the speeches, the political cartoons, you know, the campaign oratory of Democrats. They used racism in a way that would be utterly shocking today. They totally explicit. They didn't beat about the bush like people like President Trump and others do. They went right for it, you know, that this is a white man's country. Black people are inferior. They're animals. They're gorillas. They have no power, no ability to take part in government. They have no rights, as Stephen A. Douglas said, that the white man is bound to respect. Or that's what the Supreme Court said in Dred Scott. This is a white man's country. That was the Democratic Party's position. So, you know, that has changed, too.
And that does it for part one of our three-part series exploring the era of the Civil War. Our guest is preeminent Civil War historian Eric Foner, who teaches at Columbia University. His latest book is called The Second Founding, How the Civil War and Reconstruction Remade the Constitution. We hope you can join us tomorrow for part two of this conversation when we examine the relationship between Abraham Lincoln and the radical Republicans in Congress.